You're listening to WCOM Chapel Hill, Carrboro. It's 103.5 on the FM dial. And you can also listen to us on the internet at communityradio.coop. That's .coop. So today we have a guest during our summer doldrums, Carrie. Why don't you introduce yourself? Now, I know you're a student at UNC, and this show is pretty much talks about people's religious and spiritual perspectives and points of view and experiences, and that's what we're going to focus on. But why don't you give us a little background about yourself, what you're doing, where you came from, who you are, and then we'll start focusing in on what's important to you.
All right. Hi, everyone. This is Carrie. I am a student, as Paul said, at UNC, and I am studying in the pharmaceutical sciences, trying to get my PhD with a focus in medicinal chemistry. Currently, I'm working on bacteria resistance mechanisms, and so far, I'm 24 years old, so recently out of undergrad, but pretty much I grew up in Pennsylvania, lived there since I was 5 years old. Till I was 14, then I started high school back in Jersey, where I was born, and I did also my undergrad in Jersey and got a degree in chemistry. At home, I have two cats. Their names are Orion and Tyler. They are absolute sweeties. Not married, but hope to change that in a couple of years, but we'll see.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that.
So it's hope to change that in a couple of years. That means you've got somebody in your sights, huh?
Yes.
Or he's got you on your side, depending on who's got the hunter metaphor here. Okay, you got into the sciences. So how did you do that? I mean, I understand, I'm an old turkey. I haven't been in school forever, and even then it was kind of strange. But, going up through the ranks, were you in a family that was sort of driven and achievement oriented to get you through the sciences, or how did you get into the sciences specifically?
Definitely not my family. My dad is a UPS driver. My mom is a legal secretary. So mm-hmm. And she started off
good, solid,
in beauty school. So
good, solid working class people.
Yeah, my parents are wonderful. They think I look down on them because I'm going for my PhD, but I would never do that. I love my family very much.
Yeah,
and I've never been ashamed of my family. They work hard and they did everything they can to make my sister and I have the best life possible. So definitely respect my parents for that.
Yeah.
But how I got into sciences, though, ever since I was a kid, I was always with the boys running through the woods. I always used to play with all the animals. And when mm-hmm. I was young, I used to think I was going to be a veterinarian.
Okay.
And when I got to school, I noticed you can look at everything. I mean, I was always good at school, but math and science were definitely my strong points.
Oh, so you had the math gene. Who do you think you inherited that from?
That's a good question. I think my mom, but I'm not really sure.
Yeah, it seems to be a genetic trait rather than there are right. Some people who, can't add two. And, I'm lucky to put one and two after each other in consecutive order. But that's another story. So school was relatively easy for you, and you're attracted to veterinarians, and then what happened?
Well, as I got older, started to experience different sciences, and I competed when I was in middle school in Science Olympiad, and that was a good time, definitely. It was all aspects of science, and my team never won, but we still had a good time. And then when I got to high school, I had biology and then I had chemistry, and that was it right there. Chemistry, I knew, was it. And for my senior year, as an elective, I only had the option of one on the course I took because I was in all advanced placement and I only had room for one elective, and I chose organic chemistry as an independent study. And I was the first student to really do that. But I had a teacher that was willing to let me do that, so I stuck with it.
And gave you the necessary tutorial.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Right. And then when I got to college, I didn't know, started toward the end of my college career, I didn't know what area of science I wanted to go to. And I wound up doing an internship at University of Virginia, and I loved it there. But I had already done two research projects before I got there. One was computational,
mm-hmm.
and the other was screening for intramalarials. And
what's intramalarials for us than science geeks out here in the world? It's okay. That's why I'm here.
For treating malaria, because over Africa and Middle East, and there's a malaria epidemic going on.
Right.
And,
so an intramalarial is a...
be able to treat malaria.
Right. Yeah, because
it's like antibiotic levels. Treats bacterial infections, and malarial treats malaria.
Okay, without killing the patient.
Yes, that's essential when you're designing drugs. Don't want to kill the patient.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's a little strange. We haven't quite figured that out yet because I keep reading those the way they commercialize drug sales, and I've got an ethical issue about the way we've been creating a mass market for. Pharmaceuticals that are prescription based by putting them on the news and telling people to talk to your doctor about them. I think it's an absurd thing to do, and I think it's ethically wrong. But beyond that, they have to mention a few of the major side effects, and you notice that most of those major side effects, I figure we'll let all those people who pay attention to commercials ask their doctors and become the true guinea pigs for the new drugs. You know? And 20 years later, if I'm still alive and they've proven that the thing isn't too bad, I might be able to take it. That's what I always tell my doctors. I want the oldest drug possible, the one that nobody has any side effects with, you know. But be that as it may. So you got yourself into UNC, huh?
Yep.
That was a big feather in your cap.
That was exciting.
How have scholarships been pretty reasonable if you're going your way?
Yes. Undergrad, I pretty much almost had a free ride. And here, going for a PhD in the sciences, this department, what they do is they give you a stipend and they pay your tuition. So I've applied for in-state residency, so they don't have to pay so much for me to come here. But my first year was out of state, and
after a year or so, you can be in-state. Mm. So I mean, it's not that difficult.
Yeah,
I mean, you're an adult; you can live where you want, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so Carrie, so. Now, other sides of your life. So you've got a general, you know, you've got this general really positive main track interest in science. And
right.
Now, tell us a little bit about what you're doing in your research. You know, and here this will be fun because you have to make it so it's understandable to a non-science 10th grader.
I'll try my best.
That's me.
That's okay. Basically, what I do now is I work in a bacterial resistance lab. So what we do, because I'm sure a lot of people know this, that...
Staph infections.
Staph's a big problem. And MRSA is killing a lot of people in hospitals. So it's a major concern. But what our concern is that pharmaceutical companies, here's why I will refuse to work for one.
You don't have to. We won't hold you accountable.
They look at it as a business. Another reason why I also did the malaria project is that they don't want to make drugs they won't make money off of. And because bacteria become resistant to so many antibiotics very quickly, they don't make the money they want off of them. So the funding that's going into antibiotics is steadily decreasing over the years, while bacteria infections and deaths from bacteria infections are currently on the rise.
Yeah.
So you see an inverse correlation, and our research is very concerned about that, in that we don't try to design antibiotics.
Mm-hmm.
We try to bypass the resistance mechanism, and how we do that is, well, how resistance develops, a lot of times it's due to mutations in the genome. They become... There's different ways of that they can alter their genes, that they can recognize the antibiotic
and
either spit it back out, break it down, or just change the target, meaning the protein or a ribosome, which is a protein factory. So they're smart. Bacteria are very smart. when it comes to evolving.
Yeah, well, that's because they go through multiple generations. Like, if we had an opportunity to regenerate, what is it, every 12 hours or something, we might be smarter than we are. And again, we might not have had Beethoven, but be that as it may. So you have these multiple generations, and they learn to adapt to survive, right? And so they just don't go away when that death just doesn't go away. This is one of the wonderful things about the resiliency of life. Even if our planet collectively or our species collectively is too stupid to maintain its own survivability on this planet because of its reasons of maladaptive behavior, which it was seeing as short-term adaptive behavior, such as cutting down all the forests for trees for houses, which nobody will be alive to live in because there's nothing to breathe. But that's neither here nor there.
Right.
You know, we have a lot of things. We have a lot of things wrong with our economic and social system and the way we count wealth. And actually, in some ways, science are the high priests of our culture. We're going to get into a religion eventually, but let me do my little spiel about science, at least in its mega purposes. And because of that, it may be true, that I'll go, to a shaman, and have him spit on me, for some idea of a wow experience. But if I get seriously ill, I'm going to be tramping down to the clinic like everybody else to have him look at me. And, of course, the last thing in the world I want to do is go to the hospital.
Nobody does. You never want to go to the hospital.
Yeah, the worst place in the world is the hospital. And they're not good. They're not healthy places. And try to stay out of them if you can. Of course, sometimes you can't, but that's another story. But the point getting to this thing is, okay, so we have, science, they have credentials, but they don't have enough power. In other words, we have a strange connect between the money-making systems and the knowledge-making systems. The knowledge-making system has reached a pretty strong consensus, which almost for 20 years now, though, apparently, there's been this wonderful adept deaf ear to the thing that the money-making systems are refusing to hear, Global warming, environmental change, we push development way above this. We have things floating around in our system. That I don't know how many thousands of molecular level substances that never existed before World War II are floating around in our bloodstream, are floating around in our environment now. That we ingest and that we use, and we don't know what it does to us or how we'll adapt to it in the long run. I mean, the bacteria probably already adjusted to it pretty well.
Probably.
Yes, because they have a chance to, as it were, reproduce every 12 hours. We don't have this opportunity. And we're living on the edge, and we're living in a kind of cesspool of unknown chemical expectancies, and none of us can escape this. I mean, we might be able to escape some of it, but there's no one anywhere in the world that these substances haven't, penetrated as far as the biosphere goes, all the way up to the stratosphere, down to the layers of soil and our drinking water. So, we live in this thing, and so we're trying to say, get the knowledge machine, which I guess science is one of the parts of the knowledge machine, saying, hey, we really got to change things. Economics, which is a very conservative, sort of stodgy science. I mean, and I read these old economic tomes, which are impossible to find, and they're incredibly expensive. And they're finally saying, we've got to start counting things differently. Because we're not counting real wealth. We're not counting the real way that value is created on this planet. Right. Forests have an intrinsic value, and we have to have a way of accounting for it before we turn it into dead lumber.
Right.
And but it goes very slow. And the people who, you know, the entrepreneurial types see a way of making something work now or doing something work now that create value for them. And that's what they think about. They don't think about its long-term consequences. There's my concern.
Right.
What do you see yourself as a member of this collegial institution called science? You know, so we don't have to get too airy about it. In terms of responsibilities to change our societies in a way that's healthy.
Right. My future plans are to be a professor. I hope to educate those in the area so they can help perpetuate our needs. I mean, right now I chose this project to work on because I see it more as we don't need to just like treat the infections that are going on now. We need to look further. We need to find a way to outsmart the bacteria because they're outsmarting us right now, and that's not a good thing. So we need to find a way to bypass this whole entire mechanism in which they find ways around antibiotics. So I see that as helping the future in that we need to find other ways to kill off these bacteria, not just initially kill them, because they've developed these genes that become resistant to our antibiotics, and they're recently becoming faster at this process.
Mm-hmm.
The more antibiotics that come out on the market, they become resistant even faster than they did, let's say, 50 years ago. When, you know, antibiotics really started to come out.
And no magic bullets, huh?
Yeah.
No magic. There's no magic bullets out there, you know.
Right.
There's no formula that'll make it all work. We have to create a will. It's a massive will because it has to reach parts of our society which tend to look at things in a more isolated way. And, you know, since we see everything in terms, we translate everything into money, and
right.
Money can seem pretty isolated to what its actual nature of how it creates its wealth, what sustains it. And we know in a lot of ways that oil sustained wealth for the last 40, 50 years, since pretty much since the end of World War II again, not before. But we're going to, you know, it's not going to be that simple in the future, and we need to realize that we have to adapt to that, and hopefully adapt to it in a way that doesn't necessarily cause incredible population displacements on a global scale, with, you know, lots of people suffering needlessly,
right?
Because we aren't counting the real beans we have in hand. We're counting the pretend beans we thought we had in hand. And we've been counting pretend beans for way too long, and unfortunately we're still counting pretend beans. One of the great disappointments for me, though, not in this presidential campaign, is it's been a little vague, but in the last one with Kerry and what's his name, our local boy, they kept talking about development in a very unreflective way. And, you know, good jobs and development at that time. Of course, you know, they didn't win, and maybe they were never meant to win. But the, you know, and we had, they gave Bush a try, which is kind of strange. I gave him a second try when he already proved himself an imbecile. But the,
I'm sorry.
Maybe your parents wouldn't agree. I don't know.
My parents? Yeah. Oh, no. They wouldn't totally agree with that statement.
They're Democrats.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, that's unusual. Working class people who actually are voting in their own interests. that's pretty rare in our country. Yeah, well, lots of people pretend that they're richer than they'll ever be. And but that's another strange thing about our society. Okay, well, we haven't quite reached the purpose of this show yet, but I've had a fun time pontificating and asking some questions. But the But what we want to do is we're going to now explore another aspect of your life, which I guess is even more non-commercial than your science life. And why don't you explain it to me? Can you give us a little bit about your background and then the process you're going through now?
Well, let's see. Let's start when I was a child. I was raised Catholic, And mm-hmm. I discovered when I was almost an adult that the only reason I was raised Catholic was because my grandmother insisted on it and because she was a devout Catholic.
And this was on your mother or father's side?
My father's side.
Okay.
And my mother was Lutheran, so she was still Christian, but not Catholic. And my parents couldn't get married in the church because of that. Mm-hmm. So my parents were, my mother was a little disgruntled about that. And but her family was never really churchgoers.
Right.
And my dad, he went to Catholic school, and because he hated it so much, he refused to send my sister and I there.
Oh, that probably may have had some advantages.
Oh, yeah, I'm happy
you might, be a nun now.
Oh, thank God I'm not. Anyway, but we did go to a Catholic church for a while. We stopped going. My mom had cancer. She had breast cancer, had one removed, and then she had an implant put in. But she was out of commission for a while, so we stayed at home. And then when my sister and I went back to church, just the negative attitude we received when we were back. And that, to me, was kind of a defining moment in my life, that these people call themselves Christians, and they're like, you missed church. And my mom was so sick, she couldn't get out of bed. The chemotherapy just wiped her out. And my dad stayed with her, obviously. So if my dad's with my mother, mm-hmm. how am my sister not getting to church? Yeah, it wasn't on their priority list.
Yeah, and I guess the... you probably know that the Catholicism is fear-based, and
yes.
there's an authoritarian underlying of the fear. And some of it has to do with, you know, you obey the rules or you...
Mm-hmm.
You suffer the consequences, which are dire.
Right.
You know, trying to figure out what a moral and a venial sin is kind of strange for a 5-year-old, but they try to make you learn how to do it. And they don't do that as much anymore, I think. I think they changed that after Vatican II.
Mm.
But, so you do have this shadow of guilt. I was, by the way, raised Catholic, too.
And, it's very hard to let go because it's so ingrained. I struggle with it sometimes.
And I mean, I think that part of what it does for me is it gave me my interest in religion. But by the time I was 12 years old, I literally left Catholicism.
Took me a little longer, but...
And, you know, I refused to do a confirmation. I mean, I went through the confirmation classes. And actually, I had a natural penchant for theological nitpicking. But which I like to demonstrate occasionally on the show, so I really do know how many angels dance on the head of a pin, depending on how you look at it. But the fun thing is that my experience of it was left me with this terrible sense of guilt. I had a guilt about my natural processes, such as my sexual urges and desires,
right?
And giving me a sense of that they were inherently wrong, and there was a part of me that knew that was inherently crazy,
right? Yeah,
you know, and I was being, and that was there was a sense of trying to control me in a way that I shouldn't be controlled, and I saw this resistant rebelliousness, which seeped over into the culture at large. You know? And it wasn't just, so I became resistant to most authoritarian trends in our society, there's much of our society is authoritarian, so it's a tricky way of things. But I had the beatniks to inspire me. They were actually a lousy inspiration, but that's another story.
Mm.
Considering their own lives are utterly tragic and destroyed with drugs and insanity and acting out, but not the greatest moral totems of modern saints resisting the inanities of our society. So, you know, so Catholicism has its price to pay.
Yes, it does.
And, so you were raised. So did you would say you went through the not being in the school. You went through the exterior catechetical treatment, whatever it was at
Bible
that time.
Bible study, I guess, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah,
but after
religious
church,
study.
Children, would go downstairs and learn more about the Bible and blah blah blah.
Mm-hmm.
So I forget exactly what it was called. I don't remember now, but
yeah,
we went through that. I finished confirmation, but. at that point, my parents and my sister and I moved to New Jersey.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when I stopped going to church because we never bothered to find one. I was 14 at this point.
Oh.
And I still read the Bible periodically, and my mom would say, "Do you want to go to church? I'll bring you to church." And I was like, "Yeah, I'm good."
Mm-hmm.
And I went back to church near the end of my college career because, unfortunately, the man I was dating was a devout Christian, and he wanted me to go to church with him. And
that makes sense.
And yeah, and yeah. The first time I went, I said, "I don't want to go back." And he said, "Why?" Well, for one, the sermon was the role of the woman, and I do not agree with the Bible says the role of the woman is.
Yeah.
And that's mainly to be the child caretaker. And I said, "I'm sorry, being a woman of science, I'm not going to be a stay-at-home mom. That's not my sole job in the household." And my parents raised my sister and I together, and that's how I see it working.
Right.
Not that I make all the decisions about the kids, and then he goes and brings home the paycheck. Sorry, that's not how it works. And I will never follow that. And he made me feel like the worst person on the face of the earth because I didn't agree with those roles.
So he was coming from a Bible-based,
oh yeah,
Protestant.
Mm-hmm. Which is funny because his family was the complete opposite. He was the only one really, I would say, church.
He was looking for values. He's looking for internal structure.
Oh, his family. Don't even get me started.
Yeah.
No values there whatsoever.
Yeah, but what he's doing is he's looking for interior structure by finding an exterior structure that gives him a sense of certainty. Very common thing to do, but usually develop in two ways. They go, they become incredible hypocrites, and they have this chaotic inner structure which they act out in private. And then they exteriorly claim to conform to the exterior structure. That seems so they live in a life of shoulds,
mm-hmm.
the shadows of shoulds, and they never quite. And yet they feel incredible disconnect between their own chaotic desires. But the idea, though, I mean, what they're trying to do is they're trying to take that sense of exterior structure and put it inside them, and then, of course, it doesn't quite fit. It's a very difficult thing to do. I'm sympathetic with people who do it. And a lot of people who are attracted to authoritarian religions tend to be the type whose own interior structure is undisciplined. Now, you've got just because of your science and school experience, mm-hmm. you have a disciplined inner structure.
Right.
That would be resistant of any kind of mumble jumble, and you'd also be resistant to other structures, particularly ones that didn't conform to what you kind of figure is the bottom line of what seems to be real.
Right.
Yeah. So yeah, that makes sense. So okay, continue with your story about being Catholic, and now you're in New Jersey, and you're not necessarily being forced into any kind of church environment.
Well, I started going to church regularly for a little while,
mm-hmm.
to his church, not always with him, but
mm-hmm.
because we were falling apart at this point with my decision to go to grad school, and I needed comfort somewhere, and I realized I just went to be able to sing. I love to sing, and
mm-hmm.
it was just such a help to be able to lift my spirits, just to be able to sing at the top of my lungs, and it was supposed to be in praise of God, and yeah, it was, but
it also let something loose in you, huh?
Right?
Yeah.
And
it might have been God, for all we know.
Whatever it was, it helped. But
yeah.
When I got to grad school, it was a really rough time. I didn't go to church for the longest time. I just so depressed after moving away from my family and having a year and a half relationship go sour because I chose to go to grad school, which was angered me.
Yeah, I would have angered me.
Well, it was because
too.
I waited for him. He was in the military. He was overseas, and I waited for him while he was overseas. But as soon as it was an inconvenience for him, he broke up with me. So I was pretty bitter at the time.
It's understandable.
But now, after I finally got out of my depressive state and really
It took probably over a year.
Huh? Yeah, a little over a year. It took a while. Longer than I would have hoped, but you can't mm-hmm. force those things to go any faster.
Yeah, that's true.
So, but now I started looking into a friend's church because I said I liked the contemporary service. And I went to a couple churches and just didn't really find a fit. And I thought it was the church. Never really thought it was me.
Mm-hmm.
And so I started going to a friend's church. He's like, come to church. There's a contemporary service on these days, and it's mostly people your own age. So I said, okay.
And the other thing, if anything, about the friends is they're non-authoritarian.
Right. And so I went, and I really enjoyed the service, and it was such a relief because the songs were, you know, contemporary songs, and the people were so nice. And when I started dating my current boyfriend, he pointed out to me, he's like, you go to church for the social aspect. You don't go to worship. And it angered me. But then I realized, you know, he's kind of right. I like the people and the singing. I don't really go because I just follow the motions while I'm there. Mm-hmm. It's not really worship. I'm just not there.
Well, yeah, you haven't dealt with the deeper aspects of the religious thing.
Yeah, and I joined the choir because I said I love to sing, and I hate choir. I'm not going back. I haven't told them yet that I'm not going back. I hate it so much.
Is this just because of the choir director?
No, the choir director is wonderful. They have a new one coming in, but nothing new with that. I mean, it's just the type of music. I just, it doesn't do anything for me. I just sit there, I sing the words and the notes, and then I go home.
Yeah.
It's so emptiness.
So somehow it doesn't pull out of you what some of the other church hymns did, huh?
No. And finally...
what do you think that is? What do you think that is? Do you have a sense of what that might be?
What, that that does nothing for me?
Yeah, that the songs, I mean musically and singing-wise, you know, what are the parts that in your experience of being a singer brings up this exalted aspect of it, the fun, but the hallelujah choir aspect of it,
what doesn't do it for me. It's very beautiful, and I appreciate it for its aesthetic values, but it just doesn't feel, I don't feel the spiritual energy like I have other times, and that's important to me because that's where I'm going now in this direction, why I'm kind of lost right now and trying to find myself, because I was going to church for a while and singing in the choir, and then I started working with the youth group, and I love working with the kids. They're great kids.
Mm-hmm.
But now I'm at that point where it's going to sound so stupid when I say this, but
it's process. Process is this does not mean that you're not stuck you're not stuck with this formulation beyond your speaking it. You can change.
Right. Well, what started me thinking and changing was the movie The Mists of Avalon, and then I actually read the book.
Uh-huh.
And to see that back in the day, and I'm starting to read more of the Avalon series. I mean, I know it's complete fiction, but they have these priestesses that are held in high regards, and it started to get me angry at Christianity because women are evil, and they're the bringers of evil, even though they're the bringers of life. And I started to think, and I said, how could we be evil if we're the bringers of life? And back in the day, they used to worship women because they were, and some people believe that it was the only way you can connect to God was to connect with a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And when I started reading about this kind of religion, I said, well, this would be considered paganism. So let me look into paganism. I never had before. And I said, I didn't even know exactly what paganism was. I just knew from my teachings that they were bad people, which I completely disagree with now. But,
They kind of, at least the way pagans have evolved in the last few decades is that they're sort of pro-natural self people.
Right.
You know, meaning that they have a pro-view of nature, and they try to fit into that as best they can. And a lot of them, socially, I don't know if this is as true anymore, but it was definitely true in the earlier days. A lot of the early pagans, women I'm talking about, because a lot of them, I'm thinking of Wicca in particular, were strongly wounded in their personal environment through the ways that women are oppressed in our society through sexual and other forms of abuse and being tyrannized over in certain ways, and you know have been hurt, and were deformed and hurt by that. And one of the ways Wicca is so Wicca became two things: it became a means of healing. And therefore, it was addressing symptoms of pain and deformity. And more recently, Wicca is becoming a deeper sense of celebration, which means the healing aspects are worked through to a degree, and you can enjoy the celebration of life. So you're starting to discover paganism. So okay, go on, about this thing. I think this is real healthy. I really do. Right.
Well, I started to read about it, and our first book I read was Christianity and Paganism: How We Should Live in Harmony. Like, basically, the motto of most pagan religions is "Harm ye none, do as you will."
Mm-hmm.
And I like that. I like that a lot. So,
right.
And also the defining difference that really stuck in my head was the difference in how they approach sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And in Christianity, you know, it's looked down upon. You shouldn't have sex before marriage. You shouldn't only
somehow
have it for recreational purposes. And
yeah,
it's dirty. It's blah, blah, blah. And I said, I don't agree with that. I'm sorry. And in Christianity, they also say, you can't follow it if you don't believe it all. And I'm like, well, I don't believe it all, so I guess I can't follow it.
Right.
And pagans view it as a celebration. It's how we create life, how life is perpetuated. And they
mm-hmm.
also see the same thing as death, that it's part of life. You have to have death to have rebirth.
Mm-hmm.
And that is completely in tune with what I've always believed innately.
Death is a part of life.
You can't live without it.
It's not separate from life.
And so people are like, ooh, death. I'm like, no.
Death is not the opposite of life. Death is a part of life.
Right. And I've never been afraid of death. Not that I'm saying I want to die today, but I understand that, well, if I did die today, then that's my time. And
it's a process.
And I shouldn't be upset because I do believe in an afterlife. So,
mm-hmm.
And I'm tired of hearing about hell. I have to say that.
So there are a lot of good entrees to pagan Wiccan views
right.
of things. Which ones have you found and are attracted to you right now?
Right now, I'm not sure if I should divulge the name of the group because they're a private group. But it's a group of women, and they're mostly Wiccan-based. And I started celebrating.
What's their tradition? You can say what their tradition is without divulging them. If you know what their tradition is.
Most of them are Wiccans, as far as I know.
Yeah. But you know what? In Wiccan, there's a whole bunch
right,
of traditions.
Right. Right. I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay, that's fine.
Because I'm new to it, so
yeah.
I never paid enough attention, I guess, to figure out.
Yeah,
but
those parsings of the Gardnerian versus the fairy tradition is minuscule, you know.
Right.
Okay.
But they celebrate, you know, the Sabbats of the year,
mm-hmm.
and I missed Beltane, which was disappointing me because I was excited about it.
So every 6 weeks you have a big holiday.
Yeah. I mean, it's usually nothing big. We do some arts and crafts, and then
mm-hmm.
whatever time of day is meant for the celebration, and that's when we start ritual, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
The first time I went wasn't actually a Sabbath. It was just it was near the equinox in March.
Mm-hmm.
And we did a water purification chant. Apparently, they do this all over the world at a specific time. Everybody sits down and then chants the water purification,
mm-hmm.
which was the first time I've ever done anything like that. And I was amazed, like, wow, this is so different from what I've been experienced to.
Was this the water and the salt water thing, or is this something else?
It's a Navajo tradition.
Okay. It's different then.
Yeah. So we sit there and we chanted and drummed for like an hour or so.
Mm-hmm.
And is intense, and I never experienced anything like that before. And the next time I went, I didn't stay for a ritual. Not that I didn't want to, I just wasn't able to. It was around Ostara, Easter time.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last one I went to was Midsummer,
mm-hmm.
and I loved it. And we lit a fire, we called the corners with torches around the circle. Set up the altar outside, and we spiral danced and sang, and it was just, I don't even have words. And
right now, in terms of pursuing a Wiccan, by the way, let me share a little history with you, just very very vaguely, because I've dealt with this. I've multiple religious identities. I was an anthropologist, and you know, I was a Sufi in the morning, and a you know, and a pagan at night, and a you know, a, you know, a Christian at other times, and a you know, a crypto rabbi some other times. And I was all these different religions, and a lot of them overlapped. So, put it mildly, I was insane. One of the things that's true with Christianity and was a defining moment of Christianity, which was devolved from its Judaism, and was a kind of a was one of the things that kept from Judaism was the idea of the exclusivism, which is if you're a Christian, you can't be anything else.
Right.
And that's continued along the way, almost to the point where you can't be saved. The saving reality of the sacrifice of Jesus is representative of the unity of the divine and the human can't happen if you don't accept it within the framework of a very narrow confines of the this church, Orthodox or even Christian. Most Protestant Christians have sort of displaced Jesus with the Bible, which is a kind of weird a weird conversion, whereas at least in Catholicism, Jesus, the reality of Jesus definitely supersedes the Bible. Unfortunately, the reality of Jesus, the body of Jesus, is now, as it were, enlivened or entombed in the church, in the living presence of the church, and it's kind of strange. So community is real important in Catholicism. Well, unfortunately, their community tends to be a little on the authoritarian side. Though there's definitely non-authoritarian movements within Catholicism, more so than in Orthodoxy, they haven't changed the authoritarian core of the church, which is the rule of old men. I call it the patriarchy, but you can be both. So as a pagan, you can be a Christian and a pagan and be perfectly happy. And, you know, of course, you should probably be quiet about your paganism to your Christian friends, because they won't be perfectly happy, because they don't understand that it's all true in the great blue, you know. So this is one of the interesting defining moments in Christianity, was this sort of monotheism, sort of a monolithic culture. And that's definitely not true in paganism. You can be all sorts of things at all times. I guess so. One of the questions I've got for you, and this might be an exploratory thing. You may not have got there yet. I don't know from what you said yet. Is there is a formal training that you go through in Wicca? The initial training, which is a year and a day, in which you go through the formal things. And that gives you, sort of entree into the coven. And then there's trainings beyond that that you can go through. Have you thought of doing any of those? Have you sought a mentor out? And again, this is, I recognize that this might be a very ongoing process with you, but I'm just curious.
I have thought about it. I knew that. I was looking into a school, but it was ridiculously expensive, and I talked to I don't know if I should divulge names, but
no, don't divulge names. No,
she basically told me that you can do all that without having to pay ridiculous tuition to do.
Yeah.
There are other ways, and
that's just one of the weird things that happened. It was basically all my pagan training was free. And I would suggest to anyone, if they're going to get your pagan training, get it free. And it was given to me, I'm going to give it away. I'm not going to sell it.
That's how I feel too. But
and you may get it. And I'd also go with obviously trust your instincts. You know, if you trust the people that you like and admire, or you find aspects of their character that you. Whatever it is that you want to explore, or whatever it is, get to know them. Get to know their story.
Right.
Yeah. So, okay, so continue with your process here.
Well, it's kind of where I am right now, I feel. And I'm not sure if I'm transitioning or incorporating or... right now, mostly how I feel is that I feel like I lead a double life when it comes to religion. When mm-hmm. I go to church, I'm Christian. And when I leave church, I'm pagan. And my pagan friends know about my church. My mm-hmm. church does not know about my pagan friends.
Right.
And it's kind of hard. And I don't want to hide it because I'm not ashamed.
Now, are you attending a friend's church, or are you attending a different denomination?
That's the problem with church, is that I went to the church that my friend goes to, but he's also my coworker, and I'm also friends with his wife. So that makes it difficult. And because, let's say I did tell him about my religious exploration, I don't want it. I'm afraid for it to get back to the ministers, because I work with the youth ministry, and I don't want them to kick me out because they're afraid I'll taint the young minds of our children. And it's...
Well, it's not a friend's church, then, is it?
What?
By friends, I mean Quaker.
Oh, I completely misunderstood. I'm sorry. No, it's not. It's Methodist denomination.
Yeah, Methodists run both hot and cold this way, because they've been colonized by the evangelicals.
Right.
So that a lot of the church leadership tends to be evangelical, which is more conservative than mm-hmm. than the membership. Probably the membership might be a little more relaxed. It depends on what their backgrounds are. Now, you know, this is a hyper-urbane area, somewhat liberal, but the Methodist clergy is more likely to have come the other way through the evangelical aspects of the things. One of the interesting things going on with Christianity today, which is that the evangelical movement, which takes its Bible and its allegiance to Jesus quite seriously and somewhat literally, and not completely literally, but not uncritically, is that they have found that the triumphalism, equated evangelicalism with Republican hegemony is somewhat hypocritical. So they're seeing issues about poverty as becoming an issue for them, and global warming and the need for stewardship of the land, And they're seeing this and getting their warrant for it through the Bible. Unfortunately, this doesn't give them a refreshed view of who women are.
Right.
I do need to say that there are ways to read the Bible critically in which you do realize that there's very good evidence for the historical Jesus, whoever he was, or the gospel witness of Jesus. Mm-hmm. Given his time, that he had a very pro view of women. In other words, he was not...
Right, yeah.
He did not emphasize their, less than beasts of burden status in society. And women's status during the time of Jesus was definitely on the low side.
Yeah.
And it comes through a little bit in the Gospels. That was thing that I do, since I'm still multi-religious, is I do tarot, as you probably know.
Yeah.
And my tarot thing, which is probably my the way I keep my toe involved in pagan things. People who do tarot are not overwhelmingly Wiccan, but or overwhelmingly pagan. But there's definitely a strong pagan influence, and the pagans have picked up the tarot cards and run with them in a way that the other traditions are been slow to pick up with. So what I'm doing is an advanced form of tarot practice. This is for somebody who really knows tarot and its basics, and this is not something for beginners. What we're doing now is we're taking a sacred book and we're applying the grid of the hermeneutic of tarot to the sacred book. But we start with totally digesting the sacred book. So the book we decided to do this as experimental is John, the Gospel of John, and the letters of John. And we were discussing last night this Samaritan woman, you know, at the well, at Jacob's well.
Okay.
In John, which is the, you know, the story. You probably heard it. It's part of one of the Gospels. You hear the story. Well, what? So we were reading the story, and we're reading it critically, and we're reading it with this view that, now, one of the things is you have to remember that there's a lot of backstory that most people don't know that makes the story more interesting than it might seem on appearances. Part of the backstory had to do with the Samaritan. Samaritans are the lost tribes of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
They were the Israelis who they were the Jews who refused to kowtow to the David kingship that put Jerusalem at the center of the kingdom, and they had their own mountain, Sichem. They had their own temple, and because they were, and they followed aspects. They followed a number of the prophets and the same book of Moses as did the Jews. So the Jews hated them. There's nothing like brothers not getting along. So as far as the Jews were concerned, at this time, the Samaritans were the lowest of the low. By the way, the Samaritans actually still exist in the Middle East. It's a very small group, but they still exist as an ethnic group. They still have their traditions, still follow their own Bible. So they still live in that same area, right? You know, which is, and it's hard to tell them from the Palestinian problem, but the Samaritans still were there. And there were about 100,000. This is, of course, about 20 years ago. I don't know what they are now with what's going on in the Middle East. So when he was talking to the Samaritan woman, then there's this little banter. Why can't you asking me, a woman, to drink water from the well? Because, a man would be polluted by the touch or even talking to a woman, particularly a woman, outcast woman, a woman who's from a tribe who's specifically, despised by the official Jews. And here's a Jewish teacher talking to her and saying, get me some water. He couldn't drink that water because to drink that water would have polluted him. And yet, and she's alluding to this to him when she's saying, you know, you want me to bring you water, you know? He said, yeah, bring me water. And then he says, well, I can bring you water that's of eternal life for which you'll never thirst. And she says, oh, you can, you know? She says, how can I get that water that I'll never thirst again and have eternal life? And he said, you know. Then they switch, and he says to her, go get your husband.
Hmm.
You know, and of course she says, and he says, yeah, you've actually had five husbands. In fact, even the man you're living with isn't one of them. <You know>? and I look at the commentaries on this. We're looking at various commentaries. We're looking at metaphysical commentaries, and we're looking at some very sort of stodgy devotional commentaries by the other people that are doing this thing. And they were all avoiding this five husbands thing to a great degree. I said, what you have here is that the story of the Samaritan woman and her acceptance of the Messiahhood, which is what part of the chapter is about, is also, it represents a symbolic death and resurrection story. He goes from the desert and he goes into the well, and the well goes down in the dark. You know, and if so, he gets from the above to the below. And I said, actually, this drinking of the water and the water from life, normal life to eternal life, is actually, symbolically, and I've also gone from discussion of baptism, which is exterior purification, to drinking the water of the well. And you have to remember that the previous time that anybody was drinking anything was at the wedding of Canaan. I said, what we have here. And is we have actually a symbolic consummation of the marriage of Cana. So it's basically they're having symbolic sex, you know. And everybody freaked when they heard this. They said, well, how do you read that? I said, well, this is not historical. We're not talking history here. This is we're talking the logic of a dream. And I said, that's the reason, that's the only why he talks about husbands. You've had all these husbands. Who are, you know, go get your husband. He's sort of confessing at that point that what they've just shared is something that only a husband and wife would share, that this eternal mm-hmm. life had this intimacy to it. But it's not stated ever explicitly in this thing. And the commentators are a little, for some reason, at least the ones we looked at the other day, were kind of, didn't want to look at it this way. But then it comes out. There are ways. I'm not telling you to become a Christian again. This is not the point of this story at all. If anything, the Samaritan woman does represent the persistence of paganism. And by the way, they have realized archaeologically for a long, long time that the pagan religion exists and thrives within Judaism, like in the Judaism of the Bible. The Bible was a patriarchal book written for the masculine patriarchy that was running the society, the literate society. And yet in the homes, there were little statuettes of Astarte. And this is clear all the way through, right through the end of the Second Temple, 70 AD. And this, so Astarte, the goddess, was worshipped in the home during this period. And this is true in the Jewish areas as well as in the Samaritan areas. The goddess was worshipped. Women worshipped the goddess. And it was kept alive in this thing. And the anti-goddess rhetoric that you get in the things. Robert Graves, who's somewhat suspect but was important in the formative understanding of things, wrote a couple of books, one of which you might want to read sometime when you're in the mood, called The White Goddess. And another one that you might enjoy, which deals with this goddess orientation of Jesus, is called King Jesus. It's one of his novels, and it's definitely a novel, it's a fictional, but it will give, it does give an orientation of Jesus as the priest of the goddess.
Oh.
And it's a very interesting take on that. Graves was a wonderfully impish poet and scholar in his own way. I don't know if you've ever seen his work before. His poetry's a little on the stodgy side. But definitely his early pagan works, most of which were written in the 40s and the 50s, are definitely of interest. Well, let's see. We're going to wrap up here. We got started a little late, so we're running a little over, and we're going to be wrapping up in a minute. So, Carrie, is there anything you would like to say?
No, I guess that's it.
You are in process. I tell you, how much more? How many more years you got with your graduate program?
About three is my guess. May give or take a semester.
Well, assuming I'm alive and I'm still doing this show in another year or two, I would like you to have an open invitation to come back.
Oh, of course.
In a year or two, or maybe sooner. But you know, if something comes up, you know, like if you get your with your pagan group and they want to come out a little bit and or want to talk about paganism. I'm really having a hard time getting pagans on this show. you know, so, and I want more of them to be on the show and represent and talk about what they do. So if you, unless some women, tell them that they can come on the show and talk about their religious experience, and I won't gobble them up, hopefully. And the, but the other thing is I'd like to, like to invite you to do is to come back and share your process then, just you know, in terms of what you've discovered and what you've learned and where you are, and anywhere you go is fine.
Sounds good.
You know, because the goddess will guide you. Blessed be. Huh?
Yeah.
You have been listening to Touchstones. I'm your host and producer, Paul Nagy. And we've been talking to, and I guess I've been talking a little bit. And I'm sorry, Carrie. Occasionally get to take carried away with my own rhetoric, I guess. But we've been talking with Carrie, who is in the process of discovering Wiccan and things, religion, which is also discovering her own value as a person and discovering the wonderful re-emergent goddess that exists within all of us and keeps us connected to the true living values of this world and of the next world as it truly is. So, thank you for being here, and this has been Paul, and this is Touchstones.